This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome, everybody, to the Big Picture for this week. Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler is sitting here addressing you. We are going to do a number of interesting things on the show today. A varied number of things, as a matter of fact, contrary to some of our big pictures. We did a survey on the website recently. We put a survey up asking our readers what they thought about the show, things we cover, all of the things involved with it. We were really overwhelmed by the response. We got a tremendous number of people responding to it. So what we're going to do today, first of all, is frame some of the ideas and philosophies we have about the show, and then we'll share a lot of your results from the survey and the second part of the big picture. There's some pros and cons in there, so we'll talk about that. And finally, we'll get to the third section of the big picture today, the final phase, the last leg of the bull market. Remember, there are three phases in any bull market. That's how you spot what's actually going on. It traditionally follows these three phases. Jim, how do we jump into this now?
Well, you know, it's rather interesting because we wanted to put the survey out there because over the last 6 months, our audience has grown by over 50%. So we were curious, you know, who is our audience? Where are these numbers coming from? And that's what prompted us to do a survey just to find out, okay, why are we getting more listeners? Is it something we're doing? What do they like? What do they dislike about the show? So what I thought would be rather interesting is we get a lot of big data, analytical data on the show that we subscribe to. And what that tells us basically is who are listeners? Where do they come from? Some of their demographic profile. It's, you know, it's what anybody in business would do. If you have customers or in this case, listeners to your show, I don't know, John, did you ever do anything like this in when you were in the media? Because I know when I did television, we were often subscribing to various data analytical services that were telling us who was watching our telecast every night, which is also very important for advertisers. If you're running a radio program, you're running a television program, you really want to know who your demographics are, because that really, in many ways, describes who your advertisers are or who you're going to go after.
Ratings have always been important as far as market share and sales. And everybody was familiar, I'm sure, in the 50s, 60s, 70s with the Nielsen rating service out there. Because if you're going to sell time to advertisers, they want to know exactly who you are talking to in your audience. And will they get a response for that if they're going to spend large amounts of money on that? I remember, Jim, they used to do back in the 1940s, they had what were called flush polls. During the high day of radio, I think in the 30s and 40s, I forget when they started it. And what they found out is that during a station break, people would run to the bathroom and flush the john. Okay. And so they could actually tell which programs people were listening to by the increase of water in any particular city. Those were, they used to call them in the industry flush bowls. So anyway, having said all of that, there's the basis for it.
Well, it was rather interesting in as one might expect, when we took a look at who is our audience. In other words, let's take a look at geographically who listens to the show. Well, surprisingly, not surprisingly, about 59% of our listeners are U.S.-based, 10% of our listeners are from Canada, and 5% from Great Britain. So 75% of our listeners come from U.S., Canada, and Britain. The other 25% was pretty widely dispersed, Asia being a big area, as well as I was really surprised, Africa and the Middle East, which kind of surprised us. But the rest basically is from the rest of the world. 75% comes from the U.S. and Canada. Now, here's an interesting thing. When we look at gender, 88% of our audience are male. So only about 12% of women listening to our show, and that's something we hope that we're going to be able to correct with some things that we're doing, and especially in some of the things that we're trying to do with lifetime income that really impacts a lot of women in terms of retirement planning. But 88% are male and 12% female.
I'd be curious about age and education, because we were, you know, education numbers came in during the elections. If you recall, if you belonged to a certain party, you tended to be more educated. The media were telling us, blah, blah, blah.
It was really surprising. 31% of our audience are boomers. This is between roughly the ages of low 50s to 65 plus. 44% of our audience are Gen Xers. And about 20% of our audience was millennials. And that really surprised me, because a lot of the topics that we cover, in many ways, that makes me happy, because one of the things that we're trying to do with lifetime income is we're trying to tell people, if you're saving for retirement, the earlier that you start in your working career, the better off you're going to be and more successful you're more likely to be in achieving your financial goals. So I was kind of glad to see that 20% of our audience was millennials. Now, here's the one that really blew me away. Almost 80% of our audience are college educated, meaning they have a four-year degree. And here's the one that really blew me away. Almost 30% of you that listen to this show are graduates, have graduate degrees, either master's or doctorate degrees. And so we have a very highly educated audience, 80% college educated, 30% with graduate degrees. On the income side, 36% of you make over $100,000 a year. 32% of you make between 50 and 100,000. And then 32% are making less than 50,000. Now, when we get to ethnicity, 85% of our audience is Caucasian, 6% is Asian, 5% Hispanic, and 3% African American. And then we get to politics, John, and here's the one I think is going to surprise you. If you were to assess the people that listen to this show, what would you say or predict is the political affiliation of our listeners?
Well, if it involves investing, and we tend to move more along the line of Austrian economics, I would expect conservative or libertarian, and that would just be the anticipation.
That's surprising. 26% of our audience is Republican, 24% Democratic. So kind of evenly split between Republicans and Democrats, 50% of our audience is independent, which reflects what I am. I'm an independent. So it's amazing that we have a lot of independents. And so if you take a look at it, most of our audience comes from the U.S. and Canada. They are mainly 88% male. And I would say they're almost, the biggest audience was Gen Xers, which really surprised me. I thought it would have been boomers, given the topics that we cover.
All right, let's move on to the topic that I'm really anxious to see, because I haven't seen any of these results yet. I'm going through them with you here. Let's go to the survey results, what people said. And this one I'm really interested in.
I would say probably at the top, the two things that really came out is the show is too long or repetitive. They would like to see break up the longer segments and more segments. So in other words, they want us to cover more topics on the show in the big picture. And that was rather interesting. So shorter segments, more topics. The overwhelming majority of our survey, and we had over 600 respondents, was basically don't change anything. I like everything that you're doing. There were requests for more book interviews that they would like me to do. And John, you remember a couple of years ago when we used to, believe it or not, folks, if you think the show is too long, at one time, John, remember when we did 5-hour shows?
Yes, I do. They got to 5. I think our record one week, based on everything was going on, was 6 hours. But even we voted and said, okay, guys, we got to quit this. This is too long. And the trend, by the way, Jim, on podcasts now, the ideal podcast, people are saying, per topic area is about 10 to 15 minutes. Any longer than that, you tend to start losing your audience.
Yeah. So shorter segments and book interviews. And now here's something, and I want to explain, is a lot of our respondents like the big picture. They like the topics. They like the macro view of the world, not only here in some of the other topics that they were covering, but they want specific investment advice. Give and say, all right, given what you're seeing going on the economy, all right, what should I do? What should I buy? And folks, we just can't do that. We're prohibited from doing that by law. Number one, I run my own brokerage firm. Number two, we're registered investment advisors. Number three, I don't know enough of you or personally enough to start making blanket recommendations, and we don't hustle programs. In other words, if you notice on our program, we have no sponsors. We have no advertisers. And there's a specific reason we do that, because if we do, we're going to have to hustle products. How many podcasts do you listen where they're pushing gold, silver, they're pushing junior mining stocks, they're pushing annuities, they're pushing some kind of product? And I know this from my days in television, where I used to do a four-minute segment on the evening news. There were a couple segments. I remember one time I was doing a segment on what to look for when you are leasing a car. These are key things you would look in the contract. This is things you want to look at to make sure you're getting a good deal. And my producer came up and says, you're not going to run that. And I go, why? He goes, the majority of our advertisers are car companies, dealerships. You're not going to run that. So, you know, when you take on sponsorships, it's going to influence the kind of topics that you're able to cover on the program. And one of the reasons we don't take on sponsors, because I don't want to, you know, have a bunch of mining companies that sponsor what we're doing. And we're always pushing either junior mining companies or we're pushing gold. Because as many of you know, as one of our respondents, I'll read a letter that was written in. This guy was nice enough to take the time to write a letter, but he appreciated the fact that when the gold market began to turn down, we were moving on to another area of investing, which was dividend stocks. And by listening to the show, he got out of his gold in gold stocks. So there was a request for more specific advice. And you know what we'll do is we'll tell you about, you know, a lot of our technicians will do this on the program. They'll tell you about what's doing well in the market. They'll tell you about rotation shifts. And some of our technicians will give an example like, well, I see a breakout of XYZ stock. This tells me that this sector could be turning around. You're going to see those kind of things, but you're never going to hear, and I would prohibit a lot of our technicians from saying, you know what? If I were you, I'd go out and buy ABC tomorrow, or I'd buy X mutual fund. We're just not going to do that. We allow them to say, hey, I'm favorable towards gold. I'm not favorable to gold. I like this sector of the market. I think this is a good play, or what's looking good right now in a rotation. You hear this a lot from the different technicians. And one of the reasons we like to have, which is one of the things that came in, you like us having different technicians and getting their perspective, because everybody looks at a chart or follows different indicators. And I think sometimes when you hear different technicians talk about the markets, but they, let's say, mention something that's making them more favorably disposed, either bullish on the markets or bearish on the markets, you will find as a good technician, they tend to go in a group because they're following the charts. And if the charts are going up, they're going to tell you they're bullish. If they're going down, they're going to tell you they're bearish. And so people like that. One thing I was really surprised is there's been a big request in a lot of the respondents to bring back the queue lines again. John, remember when we used to do queue lines? For those of you who are new listeners, we had an 800 number that you could call in, and you would state your name, where you're from, and you would have a question. And what we would do is we would play your recorded call on the show, and then I would try to answer it. A lot of people like that, and they wish that we would bring it back. And John, do you remember kind of why we stopped that?
Well, a couple of things. We had just a number of people calling in every week. And so it became repetitive. And then we had one group of people, and I swear, I can't remember where they were. I think it always came out of the same area code, and the calls came in at like 1, 2, or 3 in the morning. And I said, these guys are either drinking buddies or they are guards guarding some building, you know, in Minneapolis or something like that. And they have nothing better to do but to call in these questions. You could tell that's what they were doing. Well, they were listening to Financial Sense. And it was the same group every week. And then we quit running them. And of course, they got miffed by that because we knew what they were up to. So that was one of the reasons. After a while, it got to be a little of a hassle.
And one thing that we did as we got rid of Q-Lines, we do this segment, and we're going to do it today. It's called On the Record. And a lot of these were emails that would come in that would be, we'd kind of lump them together along a particular theme. And then, John, those are the questions we would use on the record. If you would like to see the Q-Line come back, let us know. Email us on the site. And that's something we would consider, I would say probably one of the main reasons. And I did talk radio 5 days a week, drive time radio for, gosh, decades here locally in San Diego. And we would get the same kind of questions on a daily basis. And one of the things that we tried to do is I started introducing doing interviews because I wanted to break up the show, because every single day we get the same type of questions over and over again. And so that's what happened with the Q lines. But if you'd like to see the Q lines come back, or maybe you have some questions, just email us here in the show. And if they would warrant a response, or we get enough people asking the same question, we'll bring it up on the record. Or if we get a big enough response, we'll try Q lines. Maybe we do Q lines once a month or every couple of weeks. Or if we get a good enough response, we'll start doing it on a weekly basis.
You know, it's funny, Jim, when I was doing live drive time talk radio in Denver for quite a while, we had one particular caller that would, dang, he would call in, and my producer would just put up on the call screen, it's him. And then my goal, the challenge was, can I get him off the air in 2 minutes flat, you know, before allowing him to go on. So
I had somebody like that when I was doing local talk show. I think his name was Fred. And from what I gathered, Fred had a pickup truck with a camper on it. And he'd always talk about, well, I'm heading out for the weekend. I'm taking another trip with the girls. And we didn't know if the girls were dogs or what they were, but he was quite comical. And a lot of our listening audience looked forward to Fred's phone calls because he made the show, how should I say, amusing and interesting with his questions.
Yeah, those were some of the things there that we had. So much for all of that. What about the negatives? Because sometimes critiques can be positive, meaning they're telling you things you really should be or shouldn't be doing that are really worthwhile hearing.
One of them was, they said I was repetitive. I talk about the same thing. You know, like, I like to talk about the same thing. And then I repeat it over and over. Then I talk, maybe change, and then I have you ask me the same thing, and then we talk about the same thing, and we talk about it over and over again.
And so what I'm guessing here is that, once again, we're saying the same thing in the same ways that we've been saying the same things before, and that's what you're saying right now. Am I catching what you're saying?
Getting a bit repetitive. Okay. You know, sometimes I will do that intentionally, because when I think there's a major theme or a major transition or something that's important, I will tend to cover that topic probably over several shows because I think it's important enough to warrant attention. For example, when we start getting into, and we'll cover this topic today, the final phase of the bull market, you are going to hear me talk about the final phase of the bull market and hopefully get you in a position that you don't go through another major downdraft as we did between 2000 and once again in 2007 in the Great Recession, where a lot of people lost 40, 50% of their assets. And so that is something that we will do. So anyway, Jim, you talk too much. Part of it, another criticism was pronunciation. And one was mentioned quite frequently was Ralph Acampora. And sometimes I say Ancampora versus Acampora. And my good friend Ralph lets me get away with that, but I will try to make sure next time I have Ralph on the show, I say Acampora. Other things were some of the pronunciations of some of the words. And this goes back, folks, you may not realize it, but my parents were foreign born, and I didn't learn to speak English until I was 6 or 7, because around the household, especially where we grew up, it was a foreign neighborhood. You know, my parents spoke a foreign language. They spoke Slavic around the dinner table. And it wasn't until we moved to Arizona in the mid-50s that I actually was put into school and I had to learn English. So some of that still stays with me. We'll try to work on it. And then a criticism from Chris Sheridan. He says, I say robots instead of robots. So we'll try to correct that.
Okay, overall, though, I mean, when you read it all and you've gone through all of these responses, and I think we had how many, 600 responses or something like that?
Over 600, almost 650.
So you go through them all. Your general reaction to that?
I would say probably there was, just as you had people that would respond, say, hey, the show's too long, we got an equal amount, if not more, people that say, hey, we really appreciate the in-depth coverage that you go to when you're doing the big picture versus the sound bites that we normally hear in the financial media that don't cover a topic in depth or explain it well enough. We got a lot of comments about people like the wide variety of guests we have on the program. They like the different technicians that we have. And I would say, you know, it was really nice. I mean, there were a few negative ones that I'm not going to repeat on. But if I was to sum up the negatives, it's, Jim, you suck. So we'll leave it at that. But it was interesting. One gentleman, and I'm going to read, this is from Arthur in Ontario, who was kind enough to write about some of the things that we did on the program that he liked, some of the guests that we've had on the show interviewing the authors. And one thing, and this is what we try to do, is that he goes, over the years, I accumulate, and he's referring back in the last decade, where in 2001, we began to move into commodities. And he said, over the years, I accumulated more gold and noticed a funny thing. When the price of gold was down, very few were lined up to buy. In about 2011, when we started to sell, there were buyers aplenty. So I asked the dealer if I was missing something. He just smiled a little, shook his head, and said, it's always like that. So he and his wife sold all their precious metals for a 500% gain, and they were retired. He said, I clearly remember the day we sold the last of our hoard. I walked into the dealer with a backpack and his wife trailing cautiously behind. The waiting area was full of buyers, but they were abuzzed in quickly. We sold and started to leave. When we were passed by, another gray-haired guy with a backpack and his wife walking shotgun. The two couples smiled at each other as if to say, yeah, we're on the same plan. I should have asked if they were listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour. So, very nice letter from Arthur from Ontario. Arthur, I really appreciate your input.
Okay, so we're going to do some reshaping of the Financial Sense NewsHour based on some of your surveys. Should be interesting what we come out with. So, coming up next, we are going to have On the Record, where Jim goes on the record for being on the record and redundant and repetitive. And I'll keep him on track this time as the Financial Sense NewsHour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Gordon Long, co-founder of Financial Repression Authority, joins us today. And Gordon, I want to ask you about a recent piece that you wrote. It's titled, The Next Financial Implosion is Not Going to Be About the Banks. And you specifically took a look at U.S. commercial real estate. Would you mind telling our audience a little bit about that piece and the main message behind it?
This has many of the same overtones as what we went through in the housing, but it's literally orders of magnitude larger. not just the scale of commercial real estate, which is the biggest asset in the world, commercial real estate, but also by the nature of the financing. The housing collapse, frankly, was children's play, because what we had is the worry of credit default swaps, remember AIG, that were being used to make sure you had AAA assessed assets and you were using things like collateralized debt obligations to do it. Well, you know, they came up through asset-backed securities. Well, now these commercial mortgage-backed securities roll up. They go into collateralized loan obligations, not collateralized debt obligations. They actually, first of all, go into high leverage loans. Those high leverage loans then go up into the collateralized loan obligations. They then roll up into synthetic CLOs. And I can go on from there, but the sophistication, because of the size of the deals, coupled with who's buying it. These are not deals in the real commercial real estate, and I'm talking commercial real estate overall, that are dependent on the banks as the housing were. The housing boom, the banks were really on the nut. They had sold off a lot of the mortgages, but they were sitting on them. In this case, the biggest owners of commercial real estate in the United States are insurance companies, pension plans, funds, endowments, and banks, yes, but they're the small banks. And they're the credit unions who don't sell those mortgages off. They hold them. They're local. So any kind of collapse, not even a collapse, a minor correction, 3, 5, 6% in commercial real estate has profound impact across the entire economy.
Well, welcome back to The Big Picture. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. And just very similar as we used to do with the Q lines, we do take from time to time a synopsis of many of your emails and then have Jim go on the record answering them. We don't do them individually. We try to synopsize them here because we do get a lot of emails. So let's do some of these for this part of the program. How does your firm make investment decisions?
We do a number of things. Number one, it's a team approach. One of the things that I like to spend a lot of my time is look for long secular trends. And you referenced this a couple of weeks ago, John, a piece that I wrote back in 2002 called The Next Big Thing. And what I'm looking for, when I say secular, I'm looking for a trend that is long in duration, 5 to 10 years, if not more. And you and I started doing this program in 2001, and I was very much influenced back then by a number of individuals. One was Barry Bannister, who will be featured on FS Insider next Wednesday. You're really going to want to hear that interview between Barry Bannister and Chris Sheridan. And Barry Bannister had done this long study of secular cycles in commodities. And he was saying that we were coming to the next bull market in commodities. Barry Bannister was also very influential to an individual called Jim Rogers. And Jim Rogers came up with the Rogers Material Fund, or the Commodities Fund Index. And Jim Rogers took off in 1999 with his then future wife and spent 3 years going around the world coming up with his observation in terms of what people consumed globally. And then the third individual that had a great influence on me at that time, the way I thought, was a technician by the name of John Murphy, who basically pioneered a form of technical analysis called intermarket analysis. John wrote his first book in 1994, then wrote the second book on intermarket analysis in 2004, because a lot of these intermarket relationships changed. So I began to follow intermarket relationships, Barry Bannister's work and Jim Rogers' work, and I came to the conclusion that, number one, the bull market was coming to an end. So we got out of stocks in December of 99 and began moving into commodities and foreign government sovereign bonds in early 2000. And so I like to look at long secular trends. And a lot of you know that listening to the program, a lot of that shapes what we do, because we tend to follow, we're more of a macro shop. We call it smart macro. So you hear us occasionally talk on this program on LEIs. We follow leading economic indicators, because that tells us where we are in the business cycle. And we have our own proprietary LEIs. There's 19 in total that follows the U.S. market. And then we have four that follows the global markets. And so one of the things that we're following right now, and we commented a couple of weeks ago, is not only are the LEIs ticking up, but also global LEIs are ticking up. The other thing that we bring into, and this sort of corroborates what we see going on the macro front with economic indicators, is intermarket analysis, where we follow four main asset classes. We follow commodities, we follow currencies, we follow bonds, and we follow stocks. And so much of what goes on in this world today, if you want to know what's going on in the bond market, you want to know what's going on with the dollar. You also want to know what's going on with commodities. Likewise, with the stock market, you want to know what's going on with the dollar in commodities and interest rates. So all of these things play, and it's all part of an investment team. We meet once a week, and there are six on the team, and we discuss. I might comment on the longer themes that we see coming into play. Like, for example, we covered a couple of weeks ago, infrastructure is a big thing that we see going forward. And likewise, the end of the bull market in bonds. Those are just two secular themes that we see going forward. And one of the things that really surprises me, and if you've been listening to the show for a long period of time, we talk about three legs to the investment stool. There's the fundamentals. Then there's also the technicals. What happens in the charts influences many times what's going on in the markets. And then we also talk about the politicals. And then we often get criticized. Don't talk about politics. Well, one of the things I will share with you is we get a lot of independent research, and it's very expensive. And of all the firms that we subscribe to their research, every single one of them in the last decade has added a political analyst. So they're following events with the Fed. They're following events in Washington in terms of legislation, what's going on with, let's say, the political parties. And just take a look at what happened last year, the election of Donald Trump. Look what that has done to the market. Take a look at what Brexit did. Or for that matter, take a look at what happened when Bernanke announced taper in May of 2013, or when the Fed raised interest rates a quarter of a point in December 2015. Do you remember what it was like last year? In the first 6 weeks of the year, just about every asset class was going down. Corporate bonds went down, junk bonds went down, stocks went down, commodities hit a record low. And after Brexit of last year, we hit the lowest interest rates where most of the sovereign debt in this world was negative. Almost a third of sovereign debt had negative yields, meaning you actually paid the government to lend them money. And we saw the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years. So if you don't think of what's going on in Washington or what's going on in London or the capitals of Europe or Japan or China has influence on the financial markets, you're missing a big part what moves the markets. And one of the reasons all these research firms today are using political analysts, because the government, whether it's the Federal Reserve or the government itself, is playing an increasing role in shaping in terms of market outcomes. Just as, for example, the election of Donald Trump and Brexit changed and shaped the markets last year. So, John, those are the ways that we look. We're mainly a macro-driven shop. We take a look at the big picture, what's going on with not only economic indicators here, but also overseas. We take a look at intermarket analysis to confirm what is going on economically, because it gives you an edge in terms of another way of looking at what the LEIs are saying and the implications for the investment market. And we have a team approach. We have certified market technicians, chartered financial analysts on staff, certified financial planners on staff, certified private wealth managers on staff. All of these people have an input into that investment monitoring process.
Right. Next question is, how do you handle individual clients? And I'm assuming here they're not talking about love or beatings. They're talking about how do you custom approach your clients and tailor what their needs are to how you service those needs.
Well, I mean, one of the first things that we do is we have analytical software that we like our clients to go through what is called a risk questionnaire, because probably one of the biggest things that we see over and over, which can really do a lot of harm to an individual's financial success, is a discrepancy between their own risk tolerances and the portfolio and the way that they're invested. So we like to begin our relationship with a risk questionnaire so we understand what a client's tolerance for risk is, because that helps shape the type of portfolios, or let's say the type of investment objectives we would recommend to help a client solve their goals. And why that's important, if you think about it, folks, if you go to a doctor, what's the first thing you do when you go to a doctor's office for a visit? The nurse comes in, takes your temperature, takes your blood pressure. And that risk questionnaire is very similar to, let's say, blood pressure or temperature readings. And why that's important is if you are a low-risk person, there's no way that I'm going to recommend, or our firm's going to recommend, a aggressive or high-risk portfolio, because it wouldn't be suitable. And likewise, from a medical analogy, if you have high blood pressure, why would I put you in a high-stress environment in a risky portfolio? So we start out with a risk questionnaire. The other thing that we tend to look at is take a look at your risk. And let's say on a scale of 1 to 100, let's say you're at 25, and this is what we find a lot of investors are. They're more concerned about losing money than making money, almost 2.5 times more emphasis on, let's say, protecting capital. They tend to fall into that 25, 35 category. What I find amazing is their risk tolerance is 25, 35. Their portfolios are 65, 75. In other words, their investment portfolio is not aligned with their investment risk profile. So those are two things that we look at. The other thing that we're going to look at is how their portfolio is shaped in terms of where we are in the business cycle. For example, our firm right now, given that we're in the final stage of this bull market and more likely to head into a recession sometime next year or 2019, we really don't know at this point, but we're not 100% invested in cash anymore, because they never ring the bell at a market top. And I'm always amazed at people that have low risk profiles, and yet they're 100% invested in stocks, or they're 100% invested in an asset class, which really puts them at big risk for market downturns, whether it's stock market bear markets like we saw in 2000 or 2007, or a commodity bear market as we saw in gold between 2011 and 2016. So we want to take a look at where you are in the business cycle. If you have things in your portfolio that are working, we keep them. And especially, I can think of one client who spent his entire life working for a particular company, and he had a lot of company stock. So we put that in what we call a set-aside account. And because of his age, what we basically explained, in a community property state, on the death of the first spouse, the cost basis of that particular stock would get a step up in basis, meaning that the entire capital gains would be eliminated at death. And given his income, the size of his estate, we would be saving 23% in federal capital gains taxes, and here in California, 13%. So you're talking about almost 36 or 37% savings that would be basically done away with when one spouse passed away. I had another client who came to us, and as a result of basically a recommendation of one of her children, she bought Apple stock, and the bulk of her IRA was made up of Apple stock. And she bought Apple stock when it was back down in $14, $15 a share. And that was before the stock split, when it went up to $700. So she basically had Apple stock. And we said, look, it doesn't make sense to have everything in one stock, especially in an IRA. You're doing quite well. And right now, Apple was in an uptrend. And so one of the things that we'll be doing is at some point, Apple is going to get overpriced, overvalued, and we will trim some of that back.
Okay, if we look at all of the thousands of investment firms that are out there, what would you say distinguishes your firm from all of the others?
Boy, right off the bat, I would say probably a personal touch. I mean, when you call our firm, there's actually somebody that answers the phone. One of the things that just drives me crazy, I don't know if it drives you crazy, John, you call a company, you have a service, you bought them a product, and it's press 1 for this department, press 2 for office hours, press 3 for location, press 5 to talk to this. And by the time you go through this, and then you press it, and then they take you to an individual or whoever's in that department, and they're not available, so you have to leave an answering machine. And that's one thing that we're very big on, is that personal touch. So when you call our firm, you're not going to get an answering machine. The other thing I would think that probably distinguishes us is we're more of a boutique firm, so we know our clients a lot more. We begin, and I think it's very important, if I don't care at what stage of life you are, if you're a millennial, a Gen Xer, or you're a boomer heading into retirement or currently retired, we believe in financial planning. I grew up, I started my career as a certified financial planner. And I think people that have an investment plan as well as a retirement plan or financial plan are much more likely to be successful in achieving their financial goals. And what that means is we often get involved in ways that are beneficial to the client, whether it's talking to estate planning, talking to your accountants, or helping you go through college. And I can think of a couple of cases where this is really important. We share this with you this week with a case study of one of my clients has been with us for, gosh, over 25 years, and they were subject to a possible fraud where basically a group of people that came in wanted to take their entire IRA, roll it over into this high expensive annuity that would have had a 10% surrender charge. And there was no reason to do that given what the objective was, which was to help in paying for long-term care cost. I had another client where his second marriage, her second marriage lasted for quite a long time. Her husband was very, very successful. When he passed away, he left a very, very large estate to his wife, but his wife had children from a previous marriage, and a couple of the son-in-laws got involved. Long story short, they got an attorney they recommended to the wife, and this attorney secretly had my client sign a document that would have removed her as trustee of her own assets. And the idea was, the problem was, the kids were not going to get the principal upon her death. They would get the income. And of course, they wanted the principal, and they were hoping to modify the estate plan by changing the attorney. My client was getting on in age. She's 88 years old. And one of the things that we did when she informed us she had seen an attorney, we asked for the documents, because anytime you make an important estate change, we need those documents, because should something happen to you, we need to have that. And we couldn't get the documents from the attorney, which automatically raised a red flag. Long story short, she had signed a document that removed her as trustee, and they were changing things in the trust to change the original outcome. So we got involved. We brought in another attorney, basically fired the other attorney, had a form that basically undid the previous documents, removing herself as trustee. And then another client, this person tended to be a celebrity, has since passed on. But in his early days as client, when he first came on board, he gave us a copy, as we did, his financial plan, and there were documents on his investment portfolio that didn't make sense with what was in the portfolio. Long story short, we removed him from that account when he transferred his assets to us. And about a year later, that firm was put out of business by the SEC because they were subject to fraud. Another client recently, when her mom passed away, we helped her negotiate purchasing her first home. So those are some of the things we do on the personal side. I would say on the investment side that makes us rather different is we still do individual securities, whether we're doing individual bonds, individual stocks. We do use ETFs, but we use a blend, and we're more active than passive. Most of the industry has been commoditized. So, you know, depending on your age, you come in, you get this pie chart, you're age 50, okay, this is your pie chart until you're 65. If you're 65, this is your pie chart in your investments until you pass on. And so those are the things that we do that are a little different. and it gives us somewhat of an edge in terms of the way we make decisions. But we still do things the old-fashioned way. We buy individual stocks and we buy individual bonds because we think we can better shape a portfolio's outcome.
Obviously, you make your decisions based on rational intelligence and information. So what is it you and the people at your firm read to aid in making all of your investment decisions?
Well, number one, we spend a lot of money. We spend six figures a year on institutional research that is independent. And the reason we do that, I like getting the research that we get from a firm that's independent. In other words, it's not a brokerage firm selling something because you tend to get biased results from that. And everybody remembers the scandals during the internet phase. So we subscribe to a lot of independent research that we read. Secondly, and this has to do with the show and the things that we do here, is we have access to a lot of strategists, many of whom you hear here on the program, either technicians in the first hour or on FS Insider, or sometimes occasionally on The Big Picture. So we have this fraternity of people that we are in contact constantly with that we can run ideas by, or sometimes they contact us. What are you guys seeing here? Did you pick up on this? And we exchange ideas. So that's the second thing. And then thirdly, is we have several Bloombergs in our office. And what that enables us to do, especially if you're buying bonds or individual stocks, is to take advantage of situations in the marketplace. And I can give you two examples. One is when a company issues a bond, and if it's a large bond, let's say it's issued by a major S&P 500 company, that bond offering is going to have a safety rating on it. It's going to be rated by S&P, Fitch, or somebody. But once the bond is issued, it's sold, most companies don't go back if their financial conditions change 4 or 5 years later and they have the bond re-rated. Now, I'll give you an example. Last year, during the financial crisis that we began the year, the Fed raised interest rates in December 2015. And what happened is credit spreads just blew out. And what I'm referring to there is the difference between the interest rate on sovereign bonds and the interest rate on corporate bonds. They just blew way out of the water. And we were able to pick up a telecom company who had issued a large amount of debt 4 or 5 years ago. And as a result of the amount of debt that was being raised, they were rated double B, and that is below investment grade. And so as a result of that, the interest rate on the bond was much higher, and it was selling for a discount in the market. However, Bloomberg tracks companies based on their financial conditions every single year. As a result of this bond issuance, the company was able to expand its business. Cash flow increased 4 or 5 times, and Bloomberg rated this company actually A-rated. In other words, their credit rating was upgraded as a result of the business decision and the characteristics of the business. So we were able to buy what would be an investment-grade bond at an interest rate that was basically a junk bond rating. In other words, we got an investment grade bond with a much, much higher yield. The same thing we're doing right now, given where the nature of the market is, we're going to floating rate bonds. And what happens when you have a floating rate bond, every 6 months, depending on what's going on with interest rates, they either adjust the interest rate up or down or leave it the same if there's been no change. Well, what do we know right now? We know the Fed is in a rate raising cycle. That means these adjustable rate bonds will be adjusting their interest rates up as interest rates rise, as the Fed tightens. And so we can go in with Bloomberg's and analyze these structures and find these bonds that are currently selling at a discount to the market, which means the yield is higher. And we know that within the next couple of months, 3 or 4 months, the interest rate on that bond is going to get adjusted upward. In other words, the yield is going to increase. So we're going to have the possibility of capital gains. And we also have the possibility that as rates rise, the interest rate on these bonds are going to be rising along with it. So these are things that we can do. And it's to the benefit of our clients that we can do this and we get a better return. A lot of these floating rate bonds, we're getting 4% and 5% returns right now, which is pretty good when you consider that the Treasury, let's say the 10-year Treasury is 2.4. Well, if I could get 4, 4.5, or 5% over the next couple of years, and that yield will go up as the Fed begins to raise interest rates. Right now, it's expected they will raise rates 2 more times, which means in the next 6 months, these bonds will adjust their interest rates up again. And so this is just one way, John, that we use that research in our contacts to basically take advantage of the marketplace. In fact, I mentioned that the strategists that we have contacts with and make up our fraternity that we deal with, one of them is going to be on the program next week, and I'd highly recommend you listen to it. Chris Sheridan's interview with Barry Bannister, that's coming up next week.
All right, Jim, that's the show for this week. What we would like to do is thank everybody for the survey results. We're also going to begin implementing some of these suggestions, one of which was chopping things running too long. We did have a third topic. We were going to talk about the last phase of a bull market, but we'll put that off till next week so we keep the show within moderation. Anything else we're looking forward to?
We'll know by the end of the day. We're doing this show early on Friday. We'll know the outcome of the healthcare bill, which is being debated in Congress. I'm sure that will have some implications. We were up earlier in the day. Currently at this point, the market is down about 55 points on the Dow. S&P is down about 3 points. But coming up, John, we've got just a couple of weeks left of the first quarter. So in the month of April, we will be looking at Q1 earnings. And one of the things that I was going to talk about, we'll talk about this next week, is we do expect S&P earnings to go up this year, mainly due to two sectors, the financial sector and the energy sector. Because when you start from such a low base, you know, the fact that oil prices have gone from 26, they're closer to $50 a barrel, you're eventually going to start to see an increase in energy earnings going forward. And we'll talk about that next week. But I would say next on the agenda will be corporate earnings for Q1. We'll be watching that. Also, now that the Fed has met, when will we experience the next Fed rate hike? Will it come in May or will it come in June? Right now, the futures market is pricing that in June. So those are some of the things that we'll be talking about in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.